making coin noises. Welcome to Super Garbage Day, a retro video game review show where an actual garbage man and friends play a game 20 years or older that you, the listener, chooses. In every episode, we randomly pick a game submitted by the community to play, kindly discuss, and then discuss. I am your host, B. Ross. Welcome to episode 54. And joining me today is the king of the waltz himself, not a boomer gamer, Van Fernal. How are you doing?
I am good, and I'm definitely a gaming boomer, but you know, I'm here. This game, you invited me to co-host this episode, and this game really is cursed for us, I swear.
Well, exciting news, speaking of that, is moving forward, Van Fernal's the new co-host of the show, so I thank him. I asked him to come on. He's been so good on all the episodes. And I'm very excited to announce that Van Fernal will now be on every episode as much as he can be moving forward. Congratulations, everybody. We made it. We finally have a duo again. Love you very much, Mr. Miller, but I hope you're just making that good CGI money. By the way, speaking of a boomer gamer, no, I don't agree. First off, you and I are the same age. So if you're calling yourself a boomer gamer, you're calling me a boomer gamer. And we are two generations away from boomers. Video games to boomers is like them putting like a wooden nickel in a machine that you crank with your hand, and a picture of a girl like lifting up her skirt happens when you look through some binoculars.
Those are some...
We are millennials.
Very fair points you're making there. So I'll coin up a proper term for this. So let me sleep on that.
Okay. But yeah, we still got our youth about us. You know, we're the 8-bit, 16-bit era generation. So
you know, something very interesting about our particular generation is that, you know, we are the sons of boomers and everything. And I feel that we are the first generation that has been allowed to pretty much embrace their hobbies for their whole lifetime, you know, because our parents, they turn 18, they go to college, they work, they retire, etc., and they outgrew their what they liked as children, you know. It was just the way society saw it. But we are just in this arrested development that we're going to play video games until, you know, our thumbs fall off pretty much, you know.
Well, it's because video games is generational. Ever since it came out, it's now become everybody has a different term of retro, right? So people right now are going to look back on the Xbox One when they're older and be like, yeah, that was my childhood system. I think it's ever growing, but it's also ending, I think, with the direction video games and the business is going.
Right now,
I agree.
It's very disheartening when you see where the video game industry is right now. Like, it's the record profits and then record layoffs at the same time. It's kind of insane.
Oh, it's awful. It's so bad. And also, I mean, I people are going to hate that. Some people are going to not agree with this, but I'm here for it. I'm here for the current state of video gaming crashing, because this is not what it was supposed to be. It wasn't supposed to be everything has a season pass. Everything is free to play, except you can buy all this bull crap, loot boxes. You have to dedicate your life 24/7 and be 11 years old to be good at a video game online. This is not, and this may be me being an old guy, but that's not what made video games fun. Like, that's what makes it commercial, and that's what makes it profitable, is the addictive quality that the corporations have done. And now they're like buying up different studios and laying off all these people, and I'm sick of it. I want the indie scene to come back and just annihilate it. And I don't know if that's possible, because, you know, Microsoft and Sony are all about combating each other with services that are like live services, and not, they don't give a crap about physical media because they lose tons of money on that. And I don't know. I'm all for them just crashing and burning and being like, oh, well, maybe just having heart and soul in a video game, going to a store and buying a game and looking at it and holding it and owning it and actually being yours. Maybe that was what video games were about. I'm the physical media guy, so.
You know what you sound like with all these complaints right now? Guess what?
like a boomer. So there you go.
Oh my God. No, I just said it was an old guy rant.
Yep.
But I feel like everybody can agree.
You just went full get off my lawn on the like video game industry, man. So
hey, we have listeners and we have people in our community who are in their 20s and early 30s who are collectors and totally would agree. I think that people are being born now into the non-physical media and the non-owning your games, that it's going to seem weird that people owned their games, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. But that's foil hat talk.
You know, one day we should just have a talk of how it was in the good old days, you know, when to play a game, you had to either rent it or have a friend who owned it and trade a game with them to kind of play it. So we kind of had to go out of our way for our hobby. Now you can, you know, everyone has access to everything pretty much. So I think it just in general, everything, music and all that kind of stuff with streaming, there's this instant gratification and access to everything that I think makes it a little less special, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. No, I agree. I think it's just the oversaturation. And how could anybody argue that owning something you bought, you own the license to it? So for instance, I buy a game. Let me think of a game that's, let's see, Chrono Trigger. It's never being remade, right? Like, let's say I own Chrono Trigger on this SNES, right? Super expensive cartridge to own. And I know you can emulate or whatever. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how Nintendo doesn't want you to own Chrono Trigger. They want you to rebuy it. They prefer you not to own the old cart. And if I own that cart, nobody in this world is telling me I can't plop that into my Super Nintendo and play it whenever I want. Nobody is telling me that that cart's going to expire. There's nobody's going to tell me that I have to pay an extra service or a fee to download it and play it when I want. No, I own it. And that's the whole thing about media, is that we're seeing the shift now where it's going into this whole, like, you will own nothing and you'll be happy kind of thing that Ubisoft said that was weird. But to me, it's like, no, F that. Like, these are my items. I paid for them. I want to enjoy them at any time I want. And now you are seeing PlayStation, especially like Sony, taking things away that they promised if you bought, you could keep. But now you can't, because licenses are changing hands.
Yeah. And also, even with emulation right now, Nintendo is in the process of suing the creators of the Yuzu emulator. It's a Switch emulator.
That. Yeah, I saw and that recently.
It's so far, every time emulation has been challenged with like Bleem back then with the PlayStation, you know, Bleem was that PlayStation emulator. So far, the courts have always determined that emulation is perfectly legal. But this Yuzu lawsuit, I hope they fall in the same determination, because otherwise, if it swings the other way, it could just change the emulation scene as we know it, you know?
Well, so, people always are easy to say, like, well, you can just emulate this stuff. Why do you buy it? Why do you own all these physical media? You just emulate it. I'm like, at the mercy of the internet and the courts, because who's to say that in the future, Nintendo or anybody figures out some AI way to determine who is emulating stuff down to a granular scale to where you could just be sent an individual lawsuit. They can't do that if I own Chrono Trigger on the cartridge, you know? Like, I know that's a really extreme example, but I don't think, I mean, with how unknown AI is going to be incorporated into the gaming scene, especially with legality, I don't think it's a far cry to be a little worried that right now we're in the wild west of emulation. But at some point, I think they're going to drop the hammer, and you're not going to be able to emulate or even own stuff that's emulating, because it may become super illegal to have. And then you're literally a pirate and you're risking massive amounts of fines or whatever. So I don't know.
You know,
the
funny thing about all this, like, games that you emulate because you don't have, the only way to get them is buy a cartridge off eBay by someone who's selling them for a ridiculous price. First of all, buying enough email makes the company no money. So, and then these companies, a lot of them, they won't sell you the game. A lot of people, for example, Well, any game that is stuck on physical media right now, if they made a digital version, I swear people will buy it. Look, I bought Castlevania Symphony of the Night like 6 different times. If people will buy the games if they have access to them.
I did too. Yeah, it's true. But also, that's what they're hoping you would do, is that they want to own the IPs. That's why they're buying up the studios. They want to own the intellectual property, because that's what Nintendo has made all of their money off of. Whereas Microsoft and Sony have been trying to make money off innovation. And Sony, like, more Microsoft on, like, being innovative and, like, creating the Netflix of game services. And Sony more on, like, having exclusives. But they also, like, let those exclusives be on PC. Where Nintendo has always been, like, our IPs. That's why we can release our consoles that are lower in hardware specs. And I see, that's why Nintendo slams the hammer down the hardest, is because they rely heavily on their IPs never being put on anything else that isn't Nintendo or emulated or just being sold in any other fashion. Like what they did with those like Smash Brother tournaments like last year, where they released this list of ridiculous stuff saying, oh, you can have a Smash tournament, but here's a, like, you can only have this many people. It can only be for this amount of money. You have to let us know. And I was like, what is Nintendo's problem?
Oh, it's insane. No one hates the Smash community as much as Nintendo.
No kidding. But it's this, they're protecting their IPs. So I see it from their greedy little executive eyeballs. But as like a gamer, like a gamer at heart, like Miyamoto would not be cool with that. He could not be. I digress though. Yes, it is. It's a troubled waters ahead for gaming. But you know what's always going to be around is retro gaming. And that's why this community is awesome. And this hobby is amazing. And this, it'll always be here because you can't change it. We can own the games. We can always talk about old games. So anyways, other than that, how have you been doing? What's going on in your world?
Well, remember how I said this game was cursed, man? You told me, since I played a lot about Siren, you said come in, and I got so sick when you told me like that I couldn't record the episode, and then you told me you got sick too.
I got sick, yeah. I think the game is cursed. I don't know. I don't even want to mess around with that, because I half-heartedly believe in that kind of stuff. So I'm not a religious person, but I am spiritual. And it's something about this game coming into our lives and everybody getting sick and it being the kind of pain in the butt to play. Yeah, right. It's been gnarly. I mean, I've just been literally dealing with like tonsil problems and like taking care of my sick children. And then like, you know, my wife being sick off and on. And just the whole time, Siren's just been there looking at me from the emulator, the PS2 emulator. But other than that, I've released a YouTube, I started dabbling back into YouTube, as you know, because you've been a big help. And the latest YouTube video on the Xbox 360 games, like mild success. It kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, no, I've seen it. It's made quite an impact. I'm very impressed.
I'm surprised because the content, I didn't expect, you know, talking about Xbox 360 games, which is like the cheapest thing to collect right now. And not really on the radar and news, except for, you know, the marketplace shutting down soon. I didn't expect that kind of reaction. So many people like talking and commenting on it and having their opinions and being involved. It's really cool. And so like, obviously I'm working on a new video and everybody listening, Van Fernal's helping me with that too. We're just crossing swords to, I don't even know if that's the right term, but we're working on the next video and hopefully it's going to be just as successful as this one, but it kind of blew my mind that this one took off, and I'm looking forward to making the next one, except for I got corrected like a million times by everybody, which is funny because, you know, I'm like, I tried to tell them when I made on the video, I'm like, hey, I am a collector and I'm a garbage man. So you're going to come at me with like specifics. I'm okay with that. I will take the criticism. I will take the corrections. All good. But man, I couldn't tell you how many comments and how many messages I got about Chrome Hounds. not being online anymore. Good Lord. I know.
Well, look, here's the thing.
Saying, buy it. It's probably going to be worth money. The disc itself is a FromSoft game that's you can't get anywhere else. Like, it might be worth money. Like, I understand you can't play it online, for f- sakes.
Yeah, the thing is, like, look, when it comes to a YouTube game, an upvote, a downvote, a comment by people who like your video, a comment by haters, it's all engagement. And that's what the game is about. And as long as there's Discord going on in that comment section, you're good, man.
Absolutely. And that's the way I looked at it. It's like, I'm not going to respond to like the trolls or people being negative. And I'll respond to like people either like, you know, correcting me or just being positive. And that's just the way to do it. It's all engagement. So it's good. Other than that, and I just submitted my sealed Game Boy Advance Toys R Us limited edition to the grading company. They just got it. So that's, I'm in this new realm of a game grader. And I know people have their feelings about like grading games and all that, but I mean, I came across this thing and it was sealed and I sent it off to be graded, and I'm going to auction it off in the Heritage auction in the next like 4 months. So I'll keep you updated on that, but kind of excited. Hopefully it gets a good grade. I don't know if you're familiar with the graded games or like the auction scene, but it's like, it's pretty fruitful, man. I've been watching it. There's a lot of money there, man. A lot of money.
Yeah, I know, but I also know there's some crazy stuff going on with the
corruption. Some
grading companies too. Like, I remember distinctly a case of someone sent a bootleg copy of Castlevania Rondo of Blood. And it got certified like almost perfect, like, and it was like flat out like just a copy. So
I did a little bit of research, and I picked the least controversial of the graders.
Yeah, that's where I was coming from. Just make sure you do your research before sending something to grade.
Yeah, for sure. But I know the Game Boy, the sealed Game Boy Advance I have is like, it's legitimately a sealed Game Boy Advance, so I'm not worried. It's not like I'm sending them. Like, could you even make a counterfeit Toys R Us edition, including Mario Kart Circuit, cardboard box sealed Game Boy Advance from 2004? Yeah, I mean, there's not even a market for that. So I haven't even seen one sold. So I'm hoping, you know, I'm hoping for the best. I don't know, but I'll update everybody along with that journey. Also, I got a Beavis and Butthead tattoo on my ankle last week, so there's that. I'm starting a 90s leg, like sleeve, or I guess sock, where I'm doing all things from like my childhood in the 90s. Like,
you gotta put things like Ren and Stimpy in there and that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna get Bobby Hill. I got Meatwad on there. I'm doing a little bit like 2000s too, because I was like, I also loved Adult Swim, but I got Meatwad on there too. So I got Eazy-E, Meatwad, and Beavis and Butthead so far. So all right, it is time for the world famous retro questions of the week. And this time I'm just going to fire off a bunch of them and we can just discuss back and forth since you're here. And they all come from Mick Keith, otherwise known as MK Keith, otherwise known as Main Quest Podcast Keith. Rest in peace, Main Quest Podcast. The first question he asked was, what are some games you enjoy that were one and done and they didn't become a franchise and don't need a sequel?
I think in my case, the thing is, the first one that popped into my mind is getting a sequel, so it will be like disqualified, because I was thinking Death Stranding.
It's not out yet. So,
yeah. So to me, it was Death Stranding. That game is the worst game I'm glad I played.
I love that game.
I played through the whole thing, but it was exhausting.
I love that game. You know that game? It was a game it was on Game Pass, and I was never going to play it otherwise because I don't own a lot of systems. Like, I literally own a PS3 is the highest PlayStation I own. But it was on, when it came on Game Pass, I was like, F it. Why not? I'll try it out. And I was like engrossed. I was like, wow, this game is clicking with me. I like this game. I like the story.
No, don't get me wrong. I enjoyed the experience because I think a lot of people got frustrated, but I think that's a game about overcoming hardship. That's the whole thing about the game. But it is definitely a chore. And once I beat it, I was like, I'm glad I beat this. I'm probably never touching this again.
Well, you get to look forward to number two, which is cool.
Yeah, so it's as of right now, it's just a single game, so there you go.
They're all right. Well, for me, obviously, it's Bassin's Black Bass. Like, it's the best fishing game ever made. It's perfect. If you've never played it, you should. It's an RPG fishing game made by a Japanese developer. And if you really want to hear a really in-depth episode on it, you can check the archives of Super Garbage Day or check out the New Game Plus episode when they pulled it from their pool and the pool that I put the game in. And they actually ended up liking it too. Spoiler alert. So Bassin's Black Bass, even though it technically has a sequel on the DS, but I don't count that. All right, you ready for the next question? Here it comes. What game did you camp outside a store for a midnight launch?
That will be Grand Theft Auto 4. I got the special edition. It came with like a steel box and a duffel bag and a big ass box and
a gun.
Yeah, and I had to just like stand outside of like around the corner at the biggest mall like it, back there in Puerto Rico to just like get the game, and spoiler alert, I felt it wasn't worth it, but you know.
That's the last Grand Theft Auto I ever played. I didn't play 5. I just don't care anymore. I don't care about 6 either. I just think like the Grand Theft Auto Online turned me off so much to like everything Grand Theft Auto that I'm like, I just don't care anymore. I think San Andreas is probably the top of the hill for me when it comes to those games.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really not that much into that series anymore. I'm on the same boat. I just don't care.
Surprisingly, my answer, because the sequel's coming out this month, but the last game I remember standing outside for was Dragon's Dogma, dude. I was obsessed. When they announced that game and I looked up like all the hype around it, I was like, this game looks amazing. So that was the last game I ever went to a midnight release for. And there was like 4 of us there, including my roommate and some girl I was seeing at the time. And she didn't give a shit. But yeah, it was Dragon's Dogma of all games on the 360. So, and the sequel's coming out soon. So, hey, 12 years later, what the fudge? Awesome. Of course, can't wait outside now for it. I can just download it.
Yeah.
So,
well, right, you still kind of have to kind of wait for the, you know, preload the game and wait till midnight for it to actually release. So it is kind of there, that excitement.
So fun. Oh, man. Yeah. So many good memories there of just sitting in your front room doing the same thing you do normally. God, the soul is gone. The soul in loving video games is gone. Anyways, last question from MK Keith. What game did you later realize was on an earlier system? And that's actually not from him. That's from me. I don't know why I said it was from MK Keith.
What game I realized before was on an earlier system?
Well, let me explain this because the way I talk is awful. But so a game that you did not realize was on, like you thought it was on a system, but actually it was on a system a generation before.
So are you saying a game that you played that turned out it's like a sequel for an older game or something? Or if there was...
I'll give you my example. Port. Like, I didn't know that there was Jurassic Park on the NES. Like, I didn't know that existed.
Okay.
I always thought Jurassic Park was just on the Genesis and the SNES. But then I found out there was a Jurassic... Not only was there a Jurassic Park on the Nintendo Entertainment System, but there was one on the Master System. And that game is probably the best of them all. But... Yeah, it's a terrible question. I mean, I don't know. I was on medication.
Well, I have a fairly recent example. Like, one of the last games I actually streamed was Pocky and Rocky for the Super Nintendo.
Oh, yeah, and that game.
That is actually a sequel to an arcade game. I did not know that it was actually the second game in a franchise.
That's crazy. And then it had a part 2, though, didn't they? Come out on consoles?
So part 2 is actually the third game in the series.
So they're doing an Earthbound thing there. Yeah, like Mother 3, Earthbound. Okay. Well, there it is. If you want to add to the retro question of the week, please join the Discord. It is free, and we have a whole channel for that. You can check out the show notes. Click the link tree and dive the F in. All right, so I think it's time that we discuss the bell of the ball. And that is this week's game, which is Siren on the PlayStation 2.
Yeah!
Siren, known as Forbidden Siren in the PAL region, is a 2003 survival horror stealth game developed by Project Siren, a development team with Japan Studios, and published by Sony Computer Entertainment for the PlayStation 2. It was originally released in Japan on November 6th and in other regions between March and April of the following year. It was directed and co-written by, Kilichiro Toyama. After he wrote and directed the original Silent Hill game for Konami in 1999. The game revolves around interconnected storylines featuring a cast of characters throughout different time periods who find themselves in the mysterious town of Haneda. It's like Canada, but Haneda?
Yep, Haneda.
Haneda. Inhabited by the Shibito, deadly zombie-like creatures who still have like a glimmer of their original soul. The player must use sight jacking, a power allowing them to see the Shibito's perspective to help deal with the threats as they progress through the motherfucking levels. All right, let's jump right into first impressions. Van Fernal, what was your first impressions of Siren?
So my first impression, it's... You have to address the elephant in the room. You already said that the game, you know, it was directed by the director of the original Silent Hill. Also, the one of the character designers, one of the enemy designers, and the background designer from the original Silent Hill there is there too, to my if I remember correctly. So the game has a lot of similarities to the original Silent Hill in terms of the theme, the gameplay, the visuals. It's basically a more Japanese version of Silent Hill. It you can't deny it out of the gate. You'll find the resemblances right away.
It is 100%. That's a perfect description. It is Japanese Silent Hill. Like if Silent Hill took place in Japan. And my first impression, we do first impression videos for the show, so you can check that out on the YouTube channel in the show notes. Van Fernal will be doing some in the future as well, now that he's co-hosting. My first impression of it was like, I loved the atmosphere it was showing originally because I like horror games. I just like horror in general. But this game was bringing so much style right from the jump. Like the sound design was freaky. The introduction was cool. I liked the name of the title. My first like 20 minutes into the game, I realized that this was like a very ambitious horror game. I mean, we'll talk more about it in graphics and audio about how it really encapsulates making you feel disturbed and unsettled. And I really think that this is like a freaky game. Like it is legitimately scary. It's even if it's aged and dated, it's PS2. It makes you feel uneasy. And that's how I felt my first impressions of it. But obviously I got the same vibes, very Silent Hill-y. I didn't know any of this information when I first played the game, when it was chosen randomly. But now that I do know this, I'm thinking, well, no duh. Obviously, it's the OG creator of Silent Hill. This was his next, you know, his next big thing. So yeah, that's how I felt about it. So let's delve into the gameplay. Why don't we? So this game is a survival horror game with slight tank controls. I mean, it has tank controls, but it's like right in between when they were trying to like fix those, you know, like that little around that Resident Evil 4 time period when they realized like we need to make this a little more fluid, and you can feel it there. But there's definitely got this atmosphere of you need to hide, you need to run, you need to explore, you need to be quiet. But it also implements these entirely new mechanics that I not since this game. Or the sequels, have I seen this implemented into survival horror, at least to this level or this degree? What do you think?
First, in terms of gameplay, I think the best way I could describe this game, it's a mission-based stealth survival horror game, which is something very weird apart like about missions, you know? Because instead of being like a Resident Evil or Silent Hill game, you know, that you have this whole story you just play through like fluidly. The game is divided into episodes throughout 3 days, I believe, with 10 different characters.
So yeah, there's 10 characters. That's crazy.
Yeah,
so ambitious.
Yeah, so you have this tiny snippets of story that are not told in a linear manner either. It jumps from one day and 1 hour to another with different characters. Sometimes the stories overlap, but overall, that is something that makes this very different. And we can go into that a little later, how you go through the objectives. But the big thing that puts this game apart is the whole concept of sidejacking. How that works is because of the phenomenon that's happening in Hanuda Village, the characters in this game have the ability to see through the eyes of someone else.
That includes the character you play as.
Yes, you can see through the eyes of any other NPC, friendly or foe, which makes for something very interesting because you spend a lot of time when you're sidejacking. You kind of it's kind of like tuning in a radio. You press the directional, the analog, and then you kind of home in to enemies, and then you can see through their eyes, and you can kind of. You have these shortcut keys to jump straight to the point of view of a certain enemy. So you spend a lot of the time just right out of the gate when you start a mission, seeing the enemies, seeing their patterns, seeing which weapons they are carrying. So you have to kind of do your homework first to get your bearings of what the mission is going to look like before you even start running around. So it's something very unique.
It's very unique. And also, I would argue that it's more of a puzzle stealth game than so much a horror game. I mean, it is unsettling. The sight jacking is crazy. You know, like being able to jump in between the sight of the actual enemies and try to see where you're at, if they can see you, or you just figure out where they are located during this mission. Not only is a cool concept and kind of way of ahead of its time for this time period, but also like it attributes, I think it owes really well to the horror genre, because if you implement this in like, say, like, I don't know, Splinter Cell, it's not as cool. But in this case, when you do it, you're gaining information like, okay, so I'm looking around trying to find like the frequency of the enemies that are in the level. And once you get their frequency, you could set it to a button. And once you can hit that button quick, you know, you quick set it and you can see from their perspective, but you can also tell where they're at and if they have a weapon, what kind of weapon they have, their movement patterns, all this stuff. And later on, we'll talk about graphics and audio, how it attributes to the horror element. But it's so cool. It's such a cool concept. And I didn't know this existed. This is the first game I've ever played, at least to my knowledge, that does something like this. And I find it to be amazing.
And it adds to the horror also, because you have a patrolling Shibito. Shibito are basically, they are pretty much undead, the undead villagers.
They're your enemies.
Yes. And the thing is, the jump scare. So this game is all about atmosphere. You're always in tension. But the jump scare, when one of you spots you and you see from the like a couple of frames from their point of view and you see yourself, that is such an unnerving feeling.
And that's new. I don't think that's never been really, I think, addressed in horror games. Seeing yourself from the enemy's viewpoint and being like, oh, crap. And I think that that's, like I said, I haven't experienced anything yet or since that has done that, or at least make you feel that way, other than maybe seeing yourself on like footage cams and like Outlast or the Outlast sequels. It's crazy to me that it's such a cool concept and I'm just finding out about it, which means it didn't really take off. I mean, I know they had sequels to this game, but that's just it's a cool concept.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was still during the PS2, PS1 era. This one was PS2, but during that time, you could feel that whenever they made a game in a genre, they kind of went, okay, so we got the survival horror. What can we do to take this formula and make it unique? Because you think about it, the survival horror games of the time, before, I would say before Resident Evil 4, they all had something very unique that set them apart from the other ones. And this one, the whole sagjacking concept, it was on a league of its own. It, as you said, no one had really done it before, and no one has really done it since.
It just shows the innovation of that creator to go from Silent Hill to Siren, and both those games be remarkable, even though they were kind of riding the coattails of the Resident Evil era, but also be so separate. And it's so crazy that this game is not well known, you know. To my knowledge, I didn't even know it existed until Kenshiro put it in the list and then got chosen.
But with everything that this game did, that you can commend for, it also does some things that are so nonsensical and rage inducing that it's not, you know, it's not all like roses over here. For example, the UI is horrible. Like the very first mission, you have to pretty much find some keys and turn on a car and drive the car. That's it. But you have to get to the keys, you press the triangle button, you get a whole bunch of prompts of things you can do. You pick up the keys, you go to the car, you hit the prompt to put the keys in the car, unlock the car, then another prompt to open the door, then another prompt to get in the car, then another prompt to turn on the car. It's ridiculous.
I know. It's bad.
What you could have done in any other game, just pressing X in a Resident Evil game, and the game will have taken care of the rest, pretty much.
Yeah,
it's really convoluted. The other thing is, this game has a very heavy reliance on stealth, but the best way to sneak around is crouching. But the characters do this
so duck slow.
Stepping.
They get slow.
They kind of goose walk, and it's so slow, but it's ridiculous. It's basically they're crouching, walking on their tippy toes, and it did get improved on the sequels. And actually, thinking back, I think Siren 2 was the first game that did this. But you know how in every stealth game you kind of prone, and once you're prone, you kind of sneak around like crouching, just a crouch run.
Yeah,
that is the first game I remember doing that. I might be wrong, but it's the first one I know, and that is a staple of pretty much every survival horror now.
Well, yeah, but I also hate stealth games. I'm just in that camp. Like, I'm just not. I don't like stealth missions in games. I can't think of a game that I enjoyed that was heavily built around stealth. But this game does it differently because it's, I think the whole idea is that you're trying to follow a story, like this crazy narrative that involves all these different characters. And you have to replay a lot of these levels from different perspectives. And it kind of gets a little convoluted. That's another problem with the game, is it's very convoluted.
It is so obtuse, especially
down to especially down to some of the what it expects you to do to solve puzzles, which is like absolutely absurd. And it hinders it. It hurts the gameplay. It didn't need that. And maybe that's something that just the creator was all about, but that wasn't very apparent in Silent Hill. And for some reason, they put full throttle, cryptic, crazy problem solving in this game. And like, I don't understand it. It hurts the game so much, unfortunately.
Yeah, so how it works basically is you get to a mission with a character, and a mission can be something as simple as go to X place. By the way, the map in this game is static, and it doesn't show you in the map.
I know either. You had to like look at it literally like a map.
Yeah, so it's like an actual map. You had to look at the landmarks there and kind of get your bearings, which is kind of cool. You get used to it after a while. But the problem is, you do the mission and you're done with it. And a lot of the stages, there is a secondary mission, which you will only know what it is if you do the mission again. And this time, the second one, you usually get a hint of what you have to do, but how you get to do it is very obtuse. Sometimes
they don't tell you anything. They don't tell you anything.
Yeah. So, and sometimes you can't do an objective because you didn't pick up an item you didn't know you have to pick up on another character's mission in another day. So there is so much stuff you can miss in this game. And the worst part is, if you don't know how to do a secondary mission, you will basically loop around to the same missions you did before. So you can actually get stuck in a loop and not know what's going on. This is a game that you 100% require a guide to get through. There's just no way you can just beat this game playing it.
Which is terrible. That's not that it's such a huge strike against it, unfortunately. Like it was unnecessary. They didn't need this crypticness. For instance, there is a mission where you have to get a Shibito to open a door, but you have to get his attention. And if you try to do it any other way, he opens the door to shoot you because it's easy to die in this game. You can get shot once or twice. Plus the Shibitos don't permanently die. So if you shoot them or kill them, they come back eventually, which also I don't agree with. I don't think that was a good move, but there is a mission where you have to get him to open the door and you think, okay, well, let's make a noise or something. But it doesn't work. What you're really supposed to do is like freeze, like take a piggy bank or something, freeze a towel, lay it across, put the piggy bank on it so that when it eventually like melts, it drops the piggy bank and breaks. And then he comes out and then you can attack him and go like, what the fuck? Like, no, nobody would have ever figured that out.
Yeah, that is the most egregious example, like the most famous one. But also there's some items that you have to find in a mission, and you're doing an escort mission and you tell a character to hide and they will hide in a locker or something. And then when they come out, they're like, oh, I found this. And I'm like, how was I supposed to know that was in there? That was just pure chance. If you don't know that you had to hide that character there, you will never find it. It's so obtuse.
There's no way any person who purchased this game without a strategy guide or access to the internet would have figured out how to beat this game on their own.
No, and the thing is,
it's impossible.
Yeah, and this is like a 2003 game, you know, that there wasn't that many resources back in the day. Like sometimes GameFAQs, if they do a good guide, also guides for this game are a hot mess because the characters have two missions and you will see, oh, in this mission, you have to find this item, but to find the item, you have to unlock this door with this character on this other mission. And there is so much legwork to do to be able to just get far in this game.
Right. And of course you have to play some of the levels over again, though, as different characters at different time periods. And when that happens, if you're able to get to that point, then you're just hyper trying to figure out what the cryptic thing you don't want to miss to just progress further into the story. And it's the biggest hit to this otherwise like really awesome gameplay and game in general.
With that said, I did enjoy going back to missions as different characters because you already know the layout of the area. You know the Chivitos. There's a total of 30 something Chivitos. Like,
well, there's not many types though. Like you figure out like there's like five or six of them total.
Right. There's like patrolling types. There's the sniper types. The bug types. We can talk about that later. You know, but it's interesting. Like I did this mission during the day with this character. Now I'm doing this with this other character at night and everything. And it's cool because the familiarity of it kind of works in your favor, you know, because you learn the layout. So I think that is actually pretty cool that you get to play the same areas over and over, because I think they're pretty well designed. Everything feels very deliberate in that aspect.
But they could have simplified it better is the problem. Like they made it so complicated and it could have been a better flow. It kind of breaks the flow of the game to have these hiccups and these like gatekeeping areas where you just don't know what the fuck to do.
No, and it gets to a point where basically the missions get unlocked and it's like this giant Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, it's a weird. Yeah, that thing's weird too. I don't understand like their whole like the. It shows you like the days and times and it looks like an Excel spreadsheet. But yes, continue, please.
Yeah. And then from there, you have to you see which missions have a secondary objective. But then you see what mission that will connect to. And if you don't see a red line for a second mission, you see a gray line, it means that there is a secondary mission, but you haven't found the requirements to be able to complete the second mission, you know? So it's like, okay, I know what I have to do here, but there's something in the game I haven't done that I have no idea what it is to be able to do the secondary mission. So it can get really frustrating.
And for a game that's really heavily built on immersion and does a great job of building a very scary atmosphere, that's such a hindrance and it's such an interruption to stop and have to look something up, you know, to instead of just being within the flow of the game. And that, like I said, that's the biggest problem this game has is are those hiccups.
Yeah, 100%.
Let's talk about, I think, the best part of the game, and that's the way it looks and the way it sounds. So this is a beautiful horror game. They use this graphics. I mean, there's so many things it does that's innovative that I haven't seen done. And I know like this in particular, like the faces, you know, like the putting the actual photorealistic faces on mapped around these texture or polygon characters adds this high level of like uncanny valley-ness to it that really adds to the atmosphere and makes it like a very siren-y thing. The only way I can describe it. I think that was a good move.
Yeah. Oh, it's so unsettling. The thing is the faces are literally photorealistic. The way they made this is they put like a half circle of cameras in front of the actors. These were actual actors, like, and they motion cap their faces, but then they kind of projected their faces on this low poly mannequin looking body. So it's very unnerving that their faces look like normal people, which actually the faces look too good for what the body models look like. And that just makes it feel so off.
It's creepy and it's perfect. It's so well done. Like, I know that was deliberate. I know like they had their hardware limitations and that's why they went that route. But I commend them for doing that. That's like so good. It's so freaky. Even from the jump, from the get go, you're like, this is making me not feel comfortable looking at these characters and seeing how this plays out. And especially like the enemies with their bloody eyes or like the spidery ones, and you know, like, It's so good. It's way freakier than Silent Hill, in my opinion. Like, yeah, so, way freakier.
So something I mentioned before that this is a very Japanese game. Something about Japanese horror that I liked over Western horror is that usually it has a less is more kind of approach, which leans more towards the disturbing than the over-the-top horrifying. And that works so well in this game because it's unnerving. The Shibito, basically, they are, for all effects and purposes, kind of like zombies, but they just look like really pale people with blood coming from their eyes.
They seem possessed, but semi-undead. It's hard to describe the Shibito.
Yeah, so, again, they just look like normal people that there's something really off with them. They have wounds and that kind of thing, but they don't feel like dead, like a zombie feels dead. It's more like something reanimated these people and they are semi alive, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, they're possessed. It's not quite a zombie. It's more of a demon, somewhere in the middle. It's somewhere in between a demon and a zombie, and it's a Shibito. And like I said, it's very innovative. Like, this game has so much innovation in it, in this horror genre, that like blows me away, especially with the sound design. The sound design is so good. The music is droning and scary. And I think I told you early on when I started playing this, we were talking on Discord, how the soundtrack sounds like the type of music I would hear when I first saw like Faces of Death, or like back in the day, like Rotten.com, terrible videos of people dying and they play this like droning, terrible sound music. It's exactly the music in this game. It's perfectly fits and matches the uncanniness of the visuals.
Yeah.
To a point where you're like, oh, this is weirding me out. This, I don't want to play this in the dark.
Yeah. At any time in this game, especially the missions that are outside, you hear the music, there's some weird religious chanting woman going on in the background. There's, you can hear the sound of a siren, kind of like a, you know, an emergency siren for like missiles, that kind of thing. It basically the same siren as in the Silent Hill games. Plus the music, it's kind of this industrial but traditional Japanese sounding music. You get bombarded with the audio of this game. Also, the Shibito themselves, they are horrifying in terms of basically that what makes the Shibito so special is that they seem to be stuck in this pattern of doing what they did in real life. So one of them will be hitting a hammer, you know, something with a hammer. The other one will be like cutting plants. And they get stuck in that routine until something, they spot you or anything. And then they just go right back to the routine. The thing is, when you're sidejacking and you sidejack a Shibito, you can actually hear from their point of view too. And you hear this heavy breathing, and then sometimes
the groaning and the breathing, and like you can hear like their plight and their evilness. It's so good.
And sometimes they just start giggling for no reason with the distorted voice. It makes you very uneasy.
They did such a good job with the visuals and sound design. It's unbelievably good. And you can tell like Silent Hill brought the original Silent Hill. Brought that whole idea of sound being an aspect of horror in a video game with like the static and like figuring out if enemies are close to you with the whole static noise, which was added a new element of fear into the gameplay. And this took it to a whole nother level, like so many levels.
Oh, and I think the worst is when a Shibito spots you and it chases you around. When you actually hide, you want to go to their point of view to see, you know, when they go back to what they were doing.
Or if they see
but
you.
But when they are altered, the sound they make, just like the groaning that sounds very distorted, it's horrifying.
Yeah, but the downside, if I'm going to give any kind of criticalness to the sound design, is that I am not a fan of the voice work. And when I first played it, did my first impression, I said out loud, I cannot wait to restart the game and switch it over to Japanese voices, because everybody has a British accent, but it's clearly in Japan. And it was throwing me off hard. It was like taking away from the horror aspect. Like if it was in Japanese and it was like the Japanese voice work, I think that adds to the whole atmosphere. But the fact that it's like really deep, like college level educated sounding British voice work for every character. And then I realized it's because there was a reason when it was developed and where it was developed that it happened that way. But you can't change the voices. It's like that no matter what, at least on the North American version.
Yeah, so, it's
our PAL in North America
version. Yeah, they are so British. And then the Japanese horror on top of that, it feels very off.
It does not mix well. It's not a good alchemy.
Yeah. So to my understanding, Forbidden Siren 2, it actually, you can have the Japanese soundtrack.
Well, apparently they fixed a lot of the problems in the first game and the second. I don't know much about it, but that's what I read, is that the second game really like resolved a lot of the first problems.
Yeah. And on the third game, there are Western and Japanese characters, and they speak their respective languages, so it contrasts. And then when the Japanese characters speak with the Western ones, some of them speak in English, so that's actually pretty cool.
That's kind of cool. Yeah, that's good attention to detail.
But and the other part thing is this British voice actors, they pronounce the names of the characters and everything in such a, for example, there's a character called Tomoko, and they call her Tomoko, Tomoko. And you're like, wow, at least if you're doing the voice acting in English, you should at least have a reference of what stuff sounds like, Aruba, instead of just reading
Jamaica,
it. Like,
ooh, I want to take you to Tomoko. That's so funny.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like. So
it's another misstep, though. Like, and it's the only part of the sound design that I just did not like. Everything else is perfect. It's perfect. for what it's trying to do. But those all you're forced to listen to the British voiceover, and I'm like, it's just this weird, man. It's like I don't know how to describe it other than it also takes you away from the atmosphere that it's trying to build around you.
Yeah, at least there's a lot of cutscenes, but they're so brief for the most part that it doesn't, you know, take you away from the game that much. If there were very long cutscenes, I will get it. But yeah, definitely the voice acting is not this game's strongest suit.
Well, I mean, with all that said and put aside, I think it's time for us to give our verdict on Siren. So you played this game a lot more than I did because, like I said, the game was cursed. I played it originally. I emulated it. I wanted to play it. I acquired a PS3 and I tried to mod it so I could play it. And I swear to God, I spent more time trying to get Siren to play on my jailbroken PS3 than I played the game. And I played hours of the game, but it was upstairs on my son's computer. And I was like not wanting to try to beat this game on an emulator on a computer. But I do. You did tell me that you played a lot of this game, right? Did you end up beating it?
Not yet. I do plan to. But the thing is, this game is to get all the missions done. It will take you 20 plus hours, between 20 or 30 hours of gameplay. I'm not even kidding. Well, there's so much stuff in this game. So yeah, because you have to replay all the missions and all that stuff. So I haven't been able to beat it. Also, something crazy about this game is that you only have to beat so much of the game to actually beat it. There's a couple of missions that send you straight to the ending cutscene.
Oh.
So it's something very weird. And also the ending cutscene, you don't really have context for it unless you play through everything in the game. So sometimes you will just jump to this cutscene and you're like, what the hell is going on? And the game ends.
Well, let me ask you this though, with how much time you put into it, what do you rate this game?
Okay, so I have to make a couple of disclaimers here. If you are looking for a linear survival horror game, let's say you like Silent Hill, Silent Hill 2, Resident Evil, and that's what you expect, stay away from this one because that's not what you're getting here, 100%. But if you're the type of person, this game, I think the enjoyment comes from the immersion of learning what the mystery of Hanuda Village is, learning about the lore. There's an archive in this game with realistic pictures, footage, IDs, and all these like tidbits of things you can see in the archive that reveal what this game is about. And it's very kind of viral type content, you know. If you're the type of person that, for example, likes Dark Souls and reading every item and finding out the story behind everything, that's what this game is more geared towards. So I am absolutely torn of what to give this game. On a scale, let's say from...
Let's do a scale of, you know, how things are ranked. You know, like S tier all the way down to like F.
Okay. So if you are a horror fan, you are about the horror and all that, I will give this game I'll give it a B plus in okay. terms of if you are strictly about more about the gameplay and more of a traditional survival horror fan, I will give it more of a C minus. Because if you're just strictly here for the gameplay and getting through the game, it's not gonna be a good time.
That's exactly what my camp is. I would give it about a C minus because I like what it's bringing to the table and I like the atmosphere and I like its innovation. However, there's so many hiccups. There's so many blockades. There's so much of having to break the immersion to look up these cryptic answers to things you're never gonna figure out that makes it not this higher level of entry. And perhaps it's a localization thing where the Japanese people and producers and game players may prefer more of this type of thing. And I can't speak on that because I'm a Western gamer, but as a dumb Western gamer who played Resident Evil, I found myself in certain times like wanting to just completely quit because I'm like, this is ridiculous. And I don't want to look forward to that happening again. A situation that is so absurd to, for me to progress just to enjoy the atmosphere more, that I can't give it a higher grade than C minus because it's so good. Otherwise, it's so well made. It's made with passion. It's beautiful. It's scary. It does everything. It holds up. It's aged well in the sense of being a creepy game. But damn, its quality of life problems really hinders it in the grand scheme.
Yeah, it's kind of the thing is, you have to applaud everything this game did well and how outside the box they were thinking. You just have to. But everything they did well comes something with something that is just as frustrating on the other hand. So it just kind of evens itself out.
Well, there you have it. So there is Siren. Thank you for the submission, Kinshiro, a part of the community. If you want to add to our submissions, all these games are picked randomly from our Patreon pool. You can check out the link to join the Patreon. It's only $2. To add a game to the whole list, which is now like 40 games, so you get a good chance. Please check out the show notes and check out the link tree, and that's the way you can get into it. Otherwise, you can join the Discord for free, also in the show notes, and just discuss things. I think it's that time, though. It's that time. It's been a while. It's time to roll the Wheel of Retro. Now that you are officially a co-host, I'm going to spin it. I wonder what is going to happen.
Oh, God.
Okay. I guess we're sticking to this genre because the next game to be reviewed, and you're going to have to play two now, Mr. Fernal, is a PS2 game that I believe is really expensive. Also survival horror, also heavily Japanese based. Can you take a wild guess what it is?
Japanese PlayStation, Fatal Frame.
It is Fatal Frame 2, Crimson Butterfly.
That was my best guess.
Oh, here we are, going right back into it. So join us next week for Fatal Frame 2. Maybe next week, maybe in a couple weeks, whenever the release, when we can get around to it. Okay, we're doing our best. But also check out the Super Garbage Day YouTube channel. Also check out Van Fernal's retro stream, also on YouTube. We're a family now, so this is our union. All the links are in the show notes. Join the Patreon if you want. You don't have to. Join the Discord because it's free and everybody in there is awesome. And shout out to everybody in there. Also want to give a shout out to Kinshiro, who is a producer level on our Patreon. So thank you. I believe this might even be his other suggestion, dude. I think he's killing it.
Isn't it nice when you submit something and you just get picked? You know, like I wouldn't know.
You've submitted, Little Ralph, like 1,000 times. You even got other people in the community submitting it into the Patreon pool. And it's got like 7 submissions and is not getting chosen. I don't know what's up with it, but I refuse to look it up until the day comes. It's become its own meme.
Well, to be fair, I did submit The Crow City of Angels, and you might just get stuck playing that one.
That's on a whole nother show. Everybody, we have another show. But it's also on the main feed here on the podcast. It's Backlog Eternal, which that show is 4 games are chosen to be voted on by the community in Discord. And the one that wins, I have to beat to completion. And so that is actually currently in the poll. So jump in the Discord and vote. It's part of one of the 4, the Crow God. I hear so many bad things about that game.
Hey, look, man, that is the team that made Perfect Weapon. So you have nothing to worry about.
Wonderful. We're on a heater now with just similar games. Also, the next episode of Backlog Eternal is going to be about Celeste. And our boy Seeky Wisdom is going to come on and talk about that. So look forward to that. I'm starting at this weekend, tomorrow. I've been putting it off, but Celeste. So I hear good things and know nothing about it. But it looks like it's right up my alley, man. I love hard platformers. So Seek, big shout out to Seeky Wisdom. Van Fernal, tell everybody how they can find you.
Well, you can find me on YouTube if you search Van Fernal, or you can actually find me also on Instagram under RetroStream. That's retro.stream. And yeah, that's pretty much the social media I'm using right now. And pretty much it's all about retro gaming in that space.
Exactly. Also, he's a part of the Super Garbage Day production now, so he's in the family. So you can also find him there here. I want to thank all the patrons. Like I said earlier, $2 can get you access to over, I guess, 10 episodes of exclusive content, like retro deep cuts and special events we run. Like the Super Garbage Bowl Part 2 is coming up. It's going to be fun. And new episodes on the way. If you got this far into the episode, please consider leaving us a review on however you're listening to this. It helps our show grow its audience and get to other people's ears. And as usual, I want to give shout outs to other shows I listen to, which is Tadpog. Tyler and Dave Play Old Games. It is such a good show. I don't know if it is one of the best retro shows I've ever heard. They've been consistent. I don't know how they're doing it. So they have like 700 episodes. They're hilarious. Retro Hangover with our boy Chris Copeland. Please check out. He's always cranking out the best retro content in the game right now. You got to check that out. And if you want to, you can check out the defunct Main Quest podcast, which doesn't exist anymore, which is bring it back, buddy. Bring it back, Keith. We love you.
We need you, Keith. Once you stop the podcast and basically the Keith extended universe went into like turmoil and everything like got messed up. We need you back, Keith. Get back in the horse, man.
And we love you, Keith. So I am B. Ross. This is Van Fernal. And as always, never judge a book by its grammar. May COD be with you and have a super garbage day. Cut to B.
Thank you for watching with my dad. I just want to say, everybody, guys, bye.